So the book of Deuteronomy, when we kind of paused a little bit early last time, because I wanted to start this section. Chapter 23 is where we'll be at. Where we will be beginning this morning. Chapter 23. And again, where are we right now? Do you remember what's going on in Deuteronomy? The second law, what's happening? We're just outside, right? We're just outside that promised land. Moses is just preaching up a storm, and we have some laws that were given before they go into the promised land. And we're sort of in a drier part of Deuteronomy right now. It's going to get kind of spicy here and there during this, but we're sort of in a drier spot because he's going through, and we talked about this at the very beginning, the onset of the book. There are various types of writing, basically, and this is sort of like Levitical type thing that we are familiar with in the giving of just the laws. Here's what you do, boom, 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 and you know, some of your chapter headings in your Bible may say sundry laws or just laws or random laws, whatever. And so they're not necessarily grouped together in any certain order. And so we'll be going through some of those. And basically, they're things that make you go, huh, you know, things you never really thought about before. And so we'll be looking at that and some various other things this morning. So beginning in 23, again, we're still in the second discourse that Moses gives, the second out of four. And in this beginning, in verses 1 through 8, they begin to talk about those who are not allowed to go into the assembly before the Lord. Those who are not allowed to go in the assembly. And so it begins to list those people. And chapter 23, verse 1, those who are emasculated cannot go. Illegitimate children cannot go. And the Amorite and the Moabite cannot be in front of the Lord and the assembly, as well as the Edomite and the Egyptian unto the third generation. So three generations later, they'll be able to be in the assembly before the Lord. And when I say in the assembly before the Lord, we're talking about going to the temple and sort of in a worship setting. They're not allowed to partake in that setting. So those are those who are excluded from that assembly. And then verses 9 through 14, we talk about war camp. You know, war camp, when you go camping for war. I don't think any of us have ever really done that before. In here, anybody? I don't. Maybe not. And so there were laws about how you're supposed to camp, and those who are supposed to be clean. And in verse 9, repeats again this phrase that we've seen over and over and over again. He says, "When you go out as an army against your enemies, you shall keep yourself from every evil thing." As you go out as an army to your enemies, you shall keep yourself from every evil thing. And then talks about those things that would make them unclean and what was supposed to happen in those situations. But that's interesting as we think about spiritual warfare, you know, fighting the good fight. As we go out as an army, we're supposed to keep ourselves free from every evil thing as well. And we can look in the New Testament and see those things that we need to keep ourselves free from that would entangle us or ensnare us. So there are some interesting applications involved in this. But 9 through 14 talks about those very things. And if you look down at verse 14, and he says, this is why you need to keep yourselves clean. This is why. He says, since the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you out, to deliver you, to defeat your enemies before you. Therefore, your camp must be holy. He must not see anything indecent among you, or he will turn away from you. I think that's a neat concept, actually, that God is walking in the midst of your camp. I just think that's really cool. And again, this is a situation that this only happened with this group of people. This type of closeness that God had only happened with the Israelites, with those descendants of Abraham. And again, does not mean that God did not have a relationship with other people, and we've seen that. You know, the reason they're going in to destroy Canaan is because they're worse than the Israelites. And he said that in this letter. He says, not because you're all that special, it's just because they're so bad. I'm using you to destroy them. And so, but this is a special relationship that he has with them and why they need to be clean. Because of that close relationship. And again, it translates very closely into our relationship with God today. And we have some miscellaneous laws here, beginning in verse 15 through 18. You shall not hand over to his master a slave who has escaped from his master. To you, he shall live with you in your midst in the place that he chooses. He shall choose if one of your towns there pleases you. You shall not mistreat him. So a runaway slave, don't mistreat a runaway slave. None of the daughters of Israel, verse 17, shall be a cult prostitute, just in case you were thinking that needed to happen. Nor shall any of the sons of Israel be a cult prostitute, and you shall not bring the hire of a harlot and the wages of the dog into the house of the Lord. So there's some things, again, keeping the nation pure. Verse 19, you shall not charge interest to your countrymen, interest on money, food, or anything that may be loaned at interest. You may charge interest to the foreigner, and we've seen that before. This difference between the foreigner and the Israelites, you know, the Israelites were not supposed to touch anything that was dead or eat anything that just kind of like died in the field. You know, you're plowing along with your donkey or whatever, and all of a sudden it falls over dead. You weren't allowed to touch it, and you couldn't eat it. But the foreigner, you could give it to him, okay? And so here in this situation, in the same kind of situation, you weren't allowed to charge interest on your countrymen. But to the foreigner, you're allowed to do that. And so there was a difference, a separation there. And he says again, so the Lord may bless you and all that you undertake in the land which you're about to enter and to possess. So again, there's always this phrase that is given to you. Do these things that it may be well with you, so that you may prosper, that God may be with you. Verses 23 or 21 through 23, we have some vows. It mentions here, it says, when you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it be sin to you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be sin from you. So, you know, just don't vow, you know, novel idea. So don't make a vow. But it's interesting here, it says, when you make a vow to the Lord, you must repay it, which when later on, when Jesus talks about let your yes be yes and your no be no, they had set up this kind of situation where, well, if I vow to God, then I really got to do that one. But if I do it by something else, lesser than God, then it's sort of less binding. And I could back out of that one. And you'll see that in some of these laws that there became these traditions. So this was the law of God, and then they wrote other books and rabbinical traditions that interpreted these laws. One book is called the Talmud, which we've heard referenced in here. And that's the kind of stuff, when Jesus is talking in the Sermon on the Mount, you have heard that it was said, commonly interpreted as, but I say to you, it's not that he's changing, and we'll get to that in just a second, it applies to something we'll be looking at. Not that he's changing, he's just clarifying where they went wrong in their traditions and how they were applying these things. And so the vows were very, very important in making sure that you vowed correctly. In eating your neighbor's produce, so you could do that in verses 24 through 25. When you enter your neighbor's vineyard, and when you may eat grapes until you are fully satisfied, and you shall not put any in your basket. And you may enter your neighbor's standing grain, and you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not wield a sickle in your neighbor's standing grain. What are we talking about here? A snack? Is that what you said? Yeah, you can snack on your neighbor's vines, but you just can't take anything away from them. That would just be socially wrong. And you can go through and pick, you know, any of you done the whole thing with wheat where you've picked the heads and rubbed the wheat and chewed on that? It's interesting, wheat, if you just sit and chew on wheat, it'll just, it's like, it becomes like a gum, actually. Random, you didn't need to know that apparently. But anyway, so, but look over in Matthew chapter Matthew chapter 12, verse 1. This happened. Matthew chapter 12, verse 1. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and eat. Okay, so this, you know, it was okay for them to do this. And then, you know, the Pharisees got involved about the Sabbath and blah, blah, blah. But this was okay for them to do. It was okay for them to do that. And we see that applied. And we'll see some other things also in this morning if we have time to get to it. So that was okay to do. But you just could not take anything with you. You couldn't load your pockets up, you know. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about potluck and that kind of stuff. But I'm just saying, this is the things that you are allowed to do. Chapter 24, we're still dealing with various laws. And then he begins to talk about the law of divorce or separation or putting your wife away. And he says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor or that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house. And she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife. And if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then the former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. Therefore, that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin in the land which your Lord gives you as an inheritance. So she was not allowed to go back. This is, again, that situation where they were given this permission to put a wife away. Look over in Matthew 19. You know, we would be remiss not to mention Matthew 19. You know, Pharisees are testing Jesus again in Matthew 19. And beginning in verse 3. Some Pharisees came to Jesus testing him, asking him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? And he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And he said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two but one flesh. Therefore, whatever God has joined together, let no man separate. Then they say to him, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? And he said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not or has not been this way. And so apparently this was a not the way it was intended to be. And this morning I do not intend for us to dive into every nuance of this, but to simply read what the Bible has. So Matthew 19, 1 through 12. The Cliff Notes version is Matthew 5, 31. Also Mark 10, 2 through 12. From the beginning it was not so. And it was such the case that his disciples said of him, if this is the relationship of a man with his wife, is like this, it's better not to marry. So even for the disciples at the time, they're thinking, well, that's kind of, that's more than maybe I can bear. I may not be able to marry if I can't put my wife away. But Jesus is, again, correcting and putting things in order. There's no other relationship that God has given us like between a husband and a wife. God is making that, making sure they understand how that is a very special thing. Here is the background to Matthew 19, 1 through 12, and then Mark 10 also. Verse 5 is interesting. So anybody who's newly married doesn't have to go to war for, how long does it say here? a year. You shall not go out to the army and be charged with any duty for a year. Which, Kara and I, when we first got married, I think, how long were we married? And then I had to go on a mission trip with the youth. We were married 2 weeks, and then I was like, all right, going off to war, going on a mission trip with the youth. And so anyway. All right. Verse 6, again, we're getting into some sundry interesting situations. You cannot take a millstone or a handmill as a pledge for a debt, because that would be taking a life in pledge. It was just placing the value of a millstone seeing the value of the millstone. If a man is caught kidnapping any of his countrymen, verse 7, the thief shall die, and he purges the evil again. Purging the evil again. Verse 8, infection of leprosy. And he uses Miriam as an example. Remember what God did to Miriam. So be careful about leprosy. Verse 10, you may make your neighbor a loan of any sort, but you shall not enter his house to take this pledge. It's interesting. You can make a loan to your neighbor or anything, but you can't enter in and take it from what he owes you. There's some propriety there. You shall not, in verse 14, you shall not oppress a hired servant. Nobody shall be oppressed, is what. And again, verse 14 is very important. Fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. And this is a situation where it kind of hedges against this concept where we're just going to kill them all. This one kid did something really bad. Let's just, wipe them off. And, you can't do that. You might want to write out there Jeremiah 31, 29 through 30, or 29 and 30. Also, Ezekiel 18:20 comes to bear. Ezekiel 18:20. Let's turn over there and look at that. This is something that, in the case of inherent sin, Ezekiel 18:20, the person who sins will die. The son will not bear the punishment of the father's iniquity, nor the father bear the punishment of the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. Which teaches against what? I'm sorry? Original sin. A child is not born sinful. The soul that sins, it will die. There's no inherent sin. Adam did not just bless us all with sin. That is not what some would espouse. Look over in John chapter 19 or John chapter 9. The case of the blind man, the man born blind. John chapter 9, verse 1. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and the disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned that this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?" What is this alluding to? And it's a concept that's even around now. Like, bad things happen to bad people. Something bad happened. Eunice must be a bad person. When Job and his friends came to comfort him, what did his friends say concerning his plight? Yes. Yes, they said, "Job, you're suffering because you did something wrong. You just need to repent." And Job was jumping up and down as much as he could with all those sores the whole time, saying, "No, no, no." And he kept appealing. He said, "I need somebody to talk to between me and God. I need an intercessor with God so that you know that I am not doing anything wrong." And so here again, 1,000 years later, the same situation. Who sinned that this man would be born blind, himself or his parents? And Jesus answered, "It was neither. that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. And the night is coming, and while I'm in the world, and I'm the light of the world. And so he spat on the dirt and made the mud and had him go wash. And then later on, after the story goes on, and the Pharisees are saying, you know, who healed you? And he's saying, you know, I don't know. I was blind, dude. You know, I could not see who healed me. But he told me what to do, and I went, and I was, you know, they asked his parents, and his parents were afraid to even respond because they were afraid of getting thrown out of the synagogue, because the synagogue was the center of Jewish, you know, it'd be like the center of Jewish community. If you're thrown out of the synagogue, you're thrown out of, you know, the bridge club and all that kind of stuff. You couldn't be involved in, you know, the things at the synagogue. And so they didn't want to answer. They said, well, he's old enough, let him answer for himself. Here came the big bus. You know, so anyway, let him answer for himself. And so he answers, and he tells them in verse 34, which is quite interesting. Where does he start? The man, in verse 30, the man answered and said to them, well, here is an amazing thing, that you do not know where he is from concerning Jesus, and yet he opened my eyes, because I kept saying he was from someplace else. We know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. Since the beginning of time, it has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And so here's a blind man who has been like this big in society forever, because he hears that evil guy. Either his parents were bad or he was bad, but here's just a bad person that begged for alms. And now he's been healed. His sight has been given back to him, and perspective has been given back to him, right? And he gives perspective to these guys that they didn't really think about, and he gives them both barrels here. He's not talking to just anybody, okay? He's talking to the religious leaders who are like the big religious guys, like the God squad, basically, is who he's talking to at this moment. And so he gives them this, and then they say, answered him, who are you? You were born entirely in sin, and you're teaching us. And so they put him out of the synagogue, okay? He was teaching them correctly about the relationship that the soul that sins, it will die. And he was putting them in perspective about even the disciples. It was a common thought. And Jesus used, in Luke chapter 13, Jesus used some current events. A tower fell on some people. Pilate had put together or quelled some sort of rebellion or killed some people, and their blood was mixed with the blood of their own of the sacrifices they were offering at that time. And these were just current events. And people thought, well, these happened because they were just really bad people. And Jesus said, no. But if you don't repent, you will also die. So you can write out there Luke chapter 13, also in reference to verses 1 through 5. To this. So John 9, 1 through 5, and then verse 34, and then Luke 13, 1 through 5. And again, this is still a common misnomer in religious circles today. Still, yes, sir? Yep, that's true. You know, if you've heard that, the challenger, you know, things happen because of consequences of sin. All right, and in the situation that was brought up with the challenger, they were told, the scientists were told, that those rings are bad, they're not going to seal. Somebody covered it up or did something because, you know, time, we're going to launch. It's going to cost us money if we replace those seals. But guess what? It ended up costing a lot more than that. So you are right, and we need to keep that in perspective also. Bad things happen because of sin, as a result of sin, but it is not because necessarily... I am such an innate sinner that all, you know, the drama of the world falls upon me. Sometimes bad things just happen. If a tower falls on you, it just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, as was referenced in Luke 13. So you're exactly right. Thank you for that. So as we move on, verse 17, you shall not pervert justice. And this is sort of a justice section, 17 through 16. really through the end of this chapter, deals with the concept of justice. In verses 17 through 18, we have justice for the weak, justice due to an alien or an orphan, nor take a widow's garment in pledge, but you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and that the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. Don't forget where you come from. Don't be so high and mighty that you would oppress the weak, that you would take from the orphan or from the widow. And so he said, you need to remember where you came from. And he says, verse 19 through 20, we're giving this, how the society was to take care of those who needed food or the needy. And verse 19, when you reap your harvest in your field and have forgotten the sheaf in the field. A sheaf, what is a sheaf? Anybody? What is a sheaf? Yeah, it's like a bundle that's been bound up. If you forgot one, oh, the back 40. There's like two back there in the corner that I completely forgot about. And he's saying, if you forget them in the field, you shall not go back and get it. It shall be for the alien and for the orphan and for the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. And when you beat for olive tree, you shall not go out over the boughs. You shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. And so they were to, you know, you take the bough and you'd beat off the olives that would fall, but you can't go back over it and just really pick it clean. Anything that was left was for the widow and the orphan. What story in the Old Testament comes to play in this situation? Ruth. Look over at Ruth, chapter 2. Naomi and Boaz. And they're going to come up again later on, too. They're getting double duty this morning. And again, the story takes place in the time period of the Judges. In Ruth chapter 2, really this 1 through 13 deals with this whole thing. But we'll skip down to, so Naomi goes out to pick and to gather. In verse 5, then Boaz said to the servant, who's in charge of the reapers? Whose young woman is this? So he thinks that she's just somebody gathering, working for. And he says, whose young woman is this? And he says, she is a young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather from the reapers among the sheaves. Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while. Then Boaz said to Ruth, listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go glean in another field. And so he begins to take care of her. And he provides for her, and he says, you can drink from the water that the servants are drinking from and provides for her and takes care of her. And so we see the heart of Boaz here. But here is this situation where this story or this application comes to play with Ruth and Boaz here as she collects for Naomi. And we'll see later on also this concept of the kinsman redeemer is also mentioned shortly. And so that is what is provided for the widow and the orphan. And then when you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not go over it again. And for the alien, and for the orphan, and for the widow, and you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. And so these are things that this whole thing, this concept of taking care of those who are weak, taking care of those who need to be taken care of by the Lord. And again, we go into some sundry laws beginning in chapter 25. If there's a dispute between men and they go to court and the judge will decide their case, they shall justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. Then it shall be if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall make him lie down and be beaten in the presence of the number of stripes according to his guilt. And so there was... depending on the severity of the situation, they were beaten, lying in the prone position. In verse 3, but he may beat him 40 times, but no more. so he does not beat him with many more stripes than these, and your brother is not degraded in your eyes. No more than 40. What do we hear in the New Testament, the tradition that was kind of set up? Yeah, was it 39 times? 40 saved one. Just in case we miscounted, we're only going to do it 39 times, just in case we miscounted. And that comes to bear. We see that in 2 Corinthians 11:24, that Paul himself had been beaten in such a way. And so that's as important. In verse 4, you shall not muzzle the ox while it is threshing. What in the world are we talking about? You shall not muzzle the ox while it's threshing. Yes. I mean, what does that look like, though? I mean, when you are using your ox when you're doing threshing, it's not even a common concept for us, but what does that look like? How is that set up mechanically? Yeah, they're in a circle, and they're spinning, depending on whatever apparatus they're using. They're walking, and so they can eat as they're walking, is basically what I understand. Is anybody, okay, some of you are shaking your head. I was not, never really used an ox for anything like that before, so. But from what I understand, they were able to eat while they were threshing, while they were working. And so the laborer is worth his hire. And we see that come to bear is mentioned in 1 Corinthians 9:9, talking about those when Paul was with the church in Corinth, it was all right for them to ask for help, but he did not. But he said it would have been all right for me to ask for help. Also in 1 Timothy 5:18, the laborer's worth is higher. Verse 5, when brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son. So this gets into a situation where we're protecting the lineage. We're protecting the name. And so what is commanded here in this situation, that if a brother dies and has no son, then the other brother, Daryl, is supposed to take that wife and then have children with her to protect and continue the lineage of his brother. And he says, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. So this is the reason in verse 6 that this is done. But the situation is mentioned here, that what if he says, I don't want to? What if I don't want to? And so beginning of verse 7, but if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate of the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elder of the city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and put his sandal of his foot and spit in his face and shall say and declare, thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. In Israel his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. And this is the concept where we see again Ruth in chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. This comes into play because the brothers were all dead. The brothers were all dead. And so Boaz steps in as a kinsman redeemer to continue that lineage with Ruth. And so I think that's a beautiful story in that book. And we see that the principles of the beginning of that, we see that here in verse 20, in chapter 25. If two men, just another sundry law in verse 11, if two men, a man and his countrymen, are struggling together, and the wife of the one comes near to deliver her husband from the hand of the one who is striking him, and puts her hand and seizes him, then you shall cut off her hand. And so, you know, that doesn't need to happen. Moving on. Verse 13. You shall not have in your bag differing weights. And again, this goes back to the system's concept of justice, 13 through 16 here. What are we talking about, differing weights?
Cheating
scales. Huh? Cheating scales. When you go pump gas, how do you know that When it's spinning around, it is actually a gallon that you're getting. How do you know that? The commissioner comes by. The commissioner! And have you seen the stamp, like the seal that's on there? The commissioner has been here. This has been checked. It's been verified, right? And so, yes, so the whole concept, you don't have two 100-gram, you know, special weights in your bag. So you have 100 grams, 50 grams, or whatever the scale is, okay? You don't have various weights for different people. Again, this concept of justice. Yes, sir?
Proverbs 11:1 says, dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord.
Exactly. Dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord. And so we need to make sure that those aren't something. And you know, just honesty in general, taking advantage of the situation. You know, there are various applications of this today where people take advantage and kind of fudge lines. In Paraguay, Paraguay's awesome. Just saying, Paraguay's awesome. But you know, like every country, they have their things. We have ours. They have theirs. And in one of their situations is there's a corrupt element in just building something. So when you build a building, you actually put into your budget bribes. You build into that budget a percentage of bribes that are going to be given. So dishonest scales and things of that nature. Bribes make things go faster, but just dishonest in how that works. So, but look in verse 16. For everyone... everyone who does these things, everyone who acts unjustly is an abomination to the Lord. So again, this concept of justice. The Bible doesn't talk about fair, right? It talks about justice. What is just and right? In this situation, these are things that are just. Things that it just should be. So remember Amalek, concerning justice. Amalek, you remember what happened in Exodus 17, 8 through 16. Amalek did to you along the way. And so he's talking about remembering what happened when they came out from Egypt and how he met you along the way and attacked you among all the stragglers at the rear, which is sort of an underhanded thing to do, right? I mean, who does that? According, Amalek does that. And so the struggler, those who are at the rear, which is typically in a military column, you have the rear guard, you know, it's because of this. It's because of this. And so they said to remember what he does. And he says, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven, and you must not forget. That's a pretty serious charge, which makes archaeology difficult when you've blotted out the name of somebody. Well, the Bible is not correct because we have no record of Amalek. Well, it says right here, they didn't want him to be known, okay? And so archaeologists have tried to use that in other situations and to their demise. So we will actually finish here this morning. Any comments, questions? Anything? Yes? That I don't know, actually. I don't know about what... Did you hear the question? Did you have to use the same device for, you know, for somebody, or was it different? I don't know exactly. We're not given much instruction here about that. I don't know. That's all I can say on that one. That would be interesting to know that. I wonder if you got to pick your own device, like as a wall. That would be torturous. Here are the things you may be beaten with. Pick one. Okay. Yes. Yes. You go out and pick one from the bush. This one will break my spine, and this one they'll send me back to get another one, so... All right. Any other questions, comments? Okay. You are dismissed. Thank you very much for your time.